this is Dr. Mark Pitstick. You're listening to Ask the Soul Doctors. I have the great news for you that no matter what your questions or quandaries in life, the Soul Doctor's diagnosis is always the same. You are perfect. You are one with the One and an integral part of Source Energy. As such, you have everything you need to handle all of life's changes and challenges with style. The more you realize this, the more you see that this Earth experience is a totally safe and magnificent adventure amidst eternity. I'm excited today to have with us a giant in the field of consciousness studies, Raymond Moody, Jr., MD, PhD. Now I'm going to call him Dr. Moody. His websites, lifeafterlife.com and raymondmoody.org. Dr. Moody is a psychiatrist, the author of the pioneering book on near-death experiences, Life After Life, and others, Life After Loss, Reunions, Glimpses of Eternity. I think I've read them all. They're all wonderful. He most recently came out with a great two-hour video called Conversations with Eben Alexander and Raymond Moody. So you'll want to read his books. You'll want to watch his video. He has training off his website, again, lifeafterlife.com. So let's dive right in. We have an opportunity to ask a very wise man. I should say that we spent a week together, 15 years ago probably, training in Nevada with his Psychomentium training. And Dr. Moody is one of the most impressive combinations of intellect and heart that I've ever met in my life. So I'm deeply honored to have him here and excited to hear his answers to those greatest questions that people have. So, Dr. Moody, if you're ready, let's dive in.
Wonderful. It's so great to be with you again, too, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you. The first question that people so often ask is, who am I?
Oh, my word. Oh, wow, wow, wow. You know, tomorrow, Mark, I'm getting ready to go away with for a few days with an old friend of mine I've known since 1976, who's a clinical psychologist, but with a spiritual orientation. And you may know that the first person I ever heard report a near-death experience was Dr. George Ritchie in 1965.
Right.
And I have known the friend that I'm going with tomorrow through that context since 1976. And tomorrow we're getting ready to go away, our wives and us, to a retreat in North Carolina where that is the very question that is asked, Mark. You know, who am I? And so by the wildest coincidence, I am prepared to sort of address that question. And, you know, just to get right to it, I mean, you know, the greatest thinkers there have ever been have struggled with this one. You know, what is it that essence, that centerpiece or that center of yourself that makes you that unique, irreducible individual person you are? And and if you think about it, especially I was kind of a philosophically attuned kid, I guess, and I remember having this conversation with myself. Oh gosh, one of the first things I woke up to just as a very early child is that this consciousness thing is pretty weird. I mean, how can this be? My first foray really was astronomy at the age of 7. That's been a passion all my life. And that really wakes you up to this because you see this vastness out there. And that sort of focuses your attention then on that I am conscious now, which is an amazing thing.
Sure.
And always from the very beginning, I have suspected that it's the consciousness that's in charge, because I'm directly aware of that. Of that, I'm sure. Everything else is kind of an inference, right? It's like from patterns in their consciousness. But where I am with it now is probably quite startling. I think that the self is a narrative self, Mark. Because, you know, do you know Elie Wiesel, the story of him?
No.
was a man who survived Auschwitz and was a wonderful, wonderful man who, after the war, became a sort of Nazi hunter and trying to track down the ones that escaped and so on. And he said, and his great wisdom, because he was a very wise man, and he said, God made man because he, capital H-E, loves stories. And, you know, if you think about it, what is a human life but a story? I used to do, before I did forensic psychiatry, I was very interested in geriatric psychiatry. And not just with, I had lots of elderly demented and so on, but also lots of older people who were just depressed or, you know, in good cognitive shape, but were having situational stress or, you know, some grief or whatever. And very articulate people. And I began to hear something which anybody will tell you if you just listen to elderly people. They'll say that at some point you develop this thing in your life where you look back and you get this uncanny impression that it has been a sort of script or like a play. And I heard Joseph Campbell, the mythologist, say that too. And now I'm beginning to sense it myself at age 69. And this is, I think, corresponds to a reality, a very deep reality. I think that, you know, what is it about a human being that makes us unique from any other species? Have they tried tools? That doesn't work. Even ravens make them. The language thing is iffy, you know, maybe dolphins or whatever. But one thing that, as far as we know, no other known species do is we tell stories, and as we go along in our life, we weave a life story. We tell our life story as it goes along. And so that's where I am with it. Plato looked at this and said that there's this immaterial entity that kind of inhabits the physical substance of the body, and he called it the soul. And of course, you know, that's a word that's very important to all of us. And at the same time, the idea that it's just very difficult to put into words exactly what that is. There've been fights about it all through the centuries, from the Middle Ages. Then in the 17th century, John Locke, in the wake of all that sort of collapse of the authority of the church, which was based on Aristotle, to enforce on people, John Locke began thinking about it, and he said that what he thought that constituted the self-identity or the personal identity was your memories, right? That it was a stream of memories. But then Hume came along and said, well, actually, that as he looks inside of himself, he's never able to see anything except specific little ideas or sensations or perceptions. And he can never identify anything in his introspective process that would correspond to some sort of stable substrate there. In other words, that it's always just flowing. And so, you know, that's the status of the philosophical debate. But as for me, I've come around to this narrative kind of concept of it.
I like it. And so from that model, Dr. Moody, what about the second question, why am I here then?
Why am I here? Well, I can take my thoughts about that from listening to thousands of people with near-death experiences who go through these, they almost die, and they have the out of the body and into this light, and they see their life in this vivid panorama. They see everything you've ever done is right there in front of you instantaneously. Now, people say that when they tell us about this subsequently, they have to relate it to us as though it were in sequence, because language is sequential. But they say in the experiencing of it, it's not sequential, that everything is there all at once. And very often they say that they experience this in the company of a being, of an illuminated being, like a being of light, of complete compassion, that's there to, you know, to sort of help them review it, or, you know, and they say that in this situation, what you see is it just stands out, both because of this compassionate, loving being you're with, but also and just in the nature of the case, that what this is all about is love and learning to love, because they say, in this panorama, you see each action of your life. But when you do, it's like you're looking at another person, right? You're seeing yourself doing the action. And you are embedded in the consciousness of the person with whom you've interacted. Hence, if you see yourself doing something mean-spirited to that other person, then you are immediately, you're feeling the sad feelings and hurt. Or if you see yourself doing something loving, then you get the good feelings back. So everybody comes back from this saying that, you know, that it's love. You know, that this is what we're here to sort of learn and to, you know, to get experience with and everything. And also, it's where I have reached with this, Mark, and I know that, you know, people in your profession and my profession might judge me as psychotic on what I'm about to say, but I have just sort of, I think that the closest you can come to a description of what this thing we're in is God's educational and entertainment medium.
I like it.
There are, you know, several billions of these little narrative threads, right, going and weaving in and out, and everybody's sort of little story going, you know, intersecting with somebody else's for some period of time and then diverging or whatever. And holy mackerel, and like Elie Wiesel said, God loves stories. Well, imagine the thrill he's getting out of this. And the idea, for example, you know, I, as you remember probably, I'm a lover of astronomy, and since age 7, and I keep up with it. And recently I read the most accurate count ever made of the number of stars. This is, of course, you know, the most accurate they can come to a statement of the number of stars in the known universe is 150 billion trillion. Now, let's say that the average star has only 4 planets around it. The sun is way out on the right-hand side of the curve because it's got more than most. But let's say the average number is 4. That's 600 billion trillion planets in the known universe. And they're beginning to hone in on the idea that it's about 1 out of 1,000 planets are Earth-like. So you think, and already they've detected some, see, like Earth-like ones in the right zone, and so the, you know, and to me it's just amazing, Mark. I think you got to admit that this is an accomplishment, that God, watching all those different things going on all those worlds, is concerned, as Pat Robertson and company think that he is, about two gay guys living together. So, I mean, you see what I'm talking about. It's, to me, it is just, we live in an amazing universe, and that, why are we here? I think part of it is the thrill of the stories. And this is, I mean, you know, this is just an amazing existence we live. Last time I talked to you, I was like, I've just never, the idea of an afterlife has never sat well with me, in the sense that it seems counterintuitive. But recently I've sort of woken up that I've run out of options in terms of that one. And so, I think there is. Oddly enough to me, it's still amazing to me. In addition to this vast one that we're in with all these complications, there's another one. You know, that this one is encompassed in some vaster thing. That's and with all of its immense infinities.
If that's not far out enough for the listeners, I don't think anything will be. Dr. Moody, I'm thinking back 15 years ago, we were having dinner in this Swiss chalet in the mountains outside Las Vegas, and I asked you, in your opinion, is there any doubt that there's an afterlife? And you said, as a scientist, I can't say irrevocably there is an afterlife, but personally, based on all the evidence I've seen, I believe there is. So,
at that point, Mark, what I was thinking was, in terms of the idea, which I maintained for a long time, that this thing that people have, which they've always called a near-death, you know, which we call now a near-death experience, but which people have had since antiquity. You know, Plato wrote about them and Democritus. And what I was getting at is that I think that that experience is what people have always called the afterlife. You see what I mean? In other words, that the whole idea of life after death is that's where it came from. That people have always known that people who come close, you know, and come back have this thing. But in terms of any sort of self-assurity of the personal survival, was still having trouble with this one. But I've had something just in the past couple of years come up, Mark, that is really just, I can't come up with any alternate frame of reference to account for this except to, I think it's the simplest thing for me to say is I think there's an afterlife.
Great. I appreciate it. Next, I'd like to ask you about this light, this presence that near-death experiencers describe, and you've worked with so many people who had empathetic near-death experiences.
Yes.
Near-death experiences. What is your current understanding of what God is like, this light, this presence?
God, somebody asked me, Mark, they say, Raymond, do you believe that God exists? I tell them quite honestly and openly, no, absolutely not. Because I say this, I say, number one, I, Raymond Moody, I know myself to be such a limited human being that any belief that I could formulate about God would be off base and distorted, you know, badly in one direction or another. And secondly, if you think about it, that sentence, Raymond, do you believe that God exists? What the emphasis of that sentence is on the word exist. I say to you, Mark, that God is bigger than the concept of existence. You see what I mean? As a logician, I can symbolize the concept of existence. That is a human notion, a concept. But God is bigger than that God. You can't put God in that limited humankind. God is, the reality of God is far greater than, you know, concepts like existence. Existence is, some philosophers of language have actually suggested that this word exist is just a figure of speech anyway, and that, you know, in logic you can symbolize it in a certain way. And what I'm saying is, really, you know, we put a lot of emphasis on it, but really it's just a concept we use in our language. And to me, God is bigger than, you know, far vaster than any sort of human concept. So I would think that from the point of view of God, that existence would be a kind of constraint or something, if you see what I mean, of a reality so vast. But to me, God is relationships. God is a personal relationship you have, And also, it is God manifest in your interpersonal our relationships with other people too, I think. And again, I say it's like a thing. God is watching everybody through everybody's eyes, in my opinion. And that it goes far beyond that, because, you know, it's, to me, God is so vast, it's, I can hardly, you know, I think it would be rather arrogant of me, for example, to exclude God from the cosmos, I mean, in the sense that, you know, God is watching over not just this human existence, but over this whole picture. So, you know, we're getting, you know, this is really vast. And so, I think that relationship is what is the crux of it to me. I can say I have a personal relationship with God, and I think as you grow older, maybe, or I think that one thing I've realized, that relationships with God are a lifelong development. You know about developmental psychology. Well, I think that as a human being ages, we go through these different life phases. Well, you know, relationship with God sort of goes along in that order too, and changes, or, you know, matures or develops. And so I think that to me, prayer kind of keeps me going. And I don't mean, by the way, give me a color TV. I mean, this is, and I don't mean save the world. I mean just very minimal, because it's basically, I pray for protection for my children and me on their behalf, mm-hmm. because they're still young. And I figure things beyond that are not my business. See, it's like to say, oh, please let GE not go under, you know, on the stock market or whatever. That's none of my business. It's like God, you know, the bigger plan, the God's plot is much better, I think, in this drama that we're in than any other solution I could come up with. So when, mostly, I see, I just sort of, surrender is the most powerful prayer, just to let it be worked out by that sort of thing, because that always ends up being the cleverest and best solution.
Oh, what a mind. Dr. Moody, let me ask you this. What can you say to people who are brought up with a certain religion, and that religion teaches some things that are, let's say, limited thinking, that there's a fiery eternal hell, that there's only one way to salvation, only one true religion, things like being...
Yes, I know. What a scary thing. Well, what an interesting topic here. Number one, if this book I'm writing is a book of... It's called God is Bigger Than the Bible. And it's about 12 ideas I have about God. And one of them is this. Listen, it's... God doesn't care whether we join a religion. You know, it's fascinating to me that many, apparently billions of people think that God is encouraging them to, or requiring them to join some particular religion. And it's fascinating to me because, number one, they can't quite get it in agreement that he seems to be, you know, requiring some to, you know, different people to join different ones, which is odd. But me, I didn't grow up religious. My grandmother, my mother's mother was kind of humorous about religion and poked humorous fun very gently at it. And my dad was very cynical about it, having been, number one, a surgeon. And everybody probably knows that personality. Number two, a professional military officer. Okay, so there's another personality. And then, in that context, see, in the Pacific Theater as a medic in World War II. And, that generation didn't talk, but I sort of gather that, as I put it together, that, he was just there because of what he saw, which must have been horror after horror, that he, his religion was nowhere with him, and that's how I grew up with that attitude. To me, it was, sorry, but I just sort of thought it was laughable. I mean, I'm sorry to be so blunt, but I'm 69 years old, and I made a lot of fun of religion when I was a child, or not a child, but an adolescent. I made parodies and so on. But God has never said a word to me about religion, and I think that I consult him about life just several times a day, and I know from his ways that he would be giving me some sort of direction on this. He gives me direction on a lot of stuff, but he doesn't communicate about religion, and I think to him it must be an item of some hilarity, because, it's just so funny, the whole picture. So God doesn't require us, or he's, I don't think he cares whether we join a religion. I really don't.
Good. Okay, I like that. And so when you say you check in with God a couple times a day, I'm interested, what ways have you found to best hear the voice of your inner self or of God?
Well, it's just a long process. It's just one thing. It's just a matter of sort of sitting and doing it. And then when you do it, it sort of starts having results. I moved back into the house that I am living in now, which is an old grist mill. And in May of 1990, and it's a grist mill that was built in 1839. And it had last been rewired when I moved in 1990, in 1950. And so I knew it needed rewiring, but I didn't have the money at that time. And 3 years and, let's see, June, July, August, 4 months later, 3 years and 4 months later, my wife one day said, well, we can get the money together now to get the rewiring, but we didn't know an electrician, so we held hands by our kitchen sink and prayed that God would send us just the right electrician. I know that seems a rather mundane concern, but this is kind of how it works, I gather, is that it's like a cosmic Bitcoin or something, I guess. It's like the point of the prayer was that maybe there's a need out there, that send us just the right electrician. You can plunge into the yellow pages, or you can reflect a moment and send it up to God. And so, and I swear all this is true, because when you have this kind of experience, it would be just very abhorrent to in any way exaggerate it. It's the reality of it that's amazing. And so what happened was that the next morning the phone rang, and Cheryl, my wife, picked it up and said hello, and a voice on the other end said, hello, this is B.R. Wilson. And Cheryl said, yes, B.R., what is it? And he said, well, your number just came up on my beeper. I swear I'm telling you the truth. And Cheryl said, well, we haven't made any phone calls this morning, B.R. What's this all about? And he said, I'm an electrician. So she said, come on over, B.R. He did. He looked around. He gave his estimate. He was walking out. It's not his estimate, but he says, looked at his inspection, walked out. Cheryl took him to the van. Just a couple of minutes later, they were back up on the porch. Less than a minute, really. Just as she was putting him into his van, he said, well, it'll be a few days before I can get out here. It's like my brother died and my mother died, had a heart attack on the way home from the funeral home. So my wife said, well, maybe my husband can help you with that, B.R. He talks to people who've been through things like that. And B.R. said, well, My mother gave me this book called Life After Life to read, and it's helping some. So, you know.
Synchronicity.
But I'm sure many other people have had such experiences. And so that's where I am with God. I think that God is, God interacts with us constantly. Yeah, this is, and incidentally, atheism is, you know, if you really think about it, and I'm talking here about what I would call rhetorical atheists, or people who make a lot of noise about it. I mean, you know, and I don't mean just mean somebody who doesn't believe in God or doesn't, you know, accept there's a God or something, but I mean the people who are positively, you know, forward with it and, you know, very vocal about it. Well, it looks to me that that is a relationship with God. You see what I mean? It's like, really, in some way, to those people, this idea of God is very deeply in them, you see, and that they are fighting against it. It's what it is. It's kind of an adolescent behavior, and I'm certainly not making any sweeping generalizations, but many atheists, these professional atheists or, you know, vocal atheists about it, are really just seem to me very adolescent in their mentality. It's a kind of nah attitude, or I don't know, just kind of an adolescent rebelliousness almost.
Well, and others, I found that they're rejecting the traditional images of God, like the big guy in the sky, when you start talking about the light, the presence, a force, like in Star Wars, they may be able to relate to that. Well, let's get on to a tough one here, and that is the death of a child, one of the toughest tragedies a person can encounter on Earth. With all of your knowledge, with all of your experience, what do you say to people who the child has passed on?
You know, I can say that I wish I had more I could say, or even more than that, I wish there was some way I could help. I had that happen to me. My first child died in 1970 at the age of 36 hours. And, you know, I still, that is something that, you know, is a terrible thing to this day. And I know that feeling. And what I have come to think about it is that it's always going to be there, that loss, and that nothing could justify it. In other words, that there's not any sort of justification that I could ever get of it, but that in terms of its effects, what it has enabled me to do is to help people who have been through a loss of a child, because that's, I do that in my counseling with people and so on. And, you know, it just comes with the understanding, I think, among both of us, that, you know, it's not ever going to get reconciled. It's, and yet your consciousness sort of grows up around it. It's always the same grief. If you regard your whole self as a kind of circle there, like about the size of a quarter or something, and then you say that when you're that whole entire self and your consciousness is almost like filled up with this so dark, you know, and that what I find, if I look at that diagram now, 40-something years hence, 43 years hence, it is still that. It's still that, you know, that just vacancy or that horror, that grief. And the difference now is that I am a circle about as big as a grapefruit. is inside of. You see what I mean? It's still the same grief, but, and it even is a little bit more, because at each stage you think, now he would have been in school, now we would have been, you know, high school, now we've been married or whatever. And so it sort of grows, but still, you know, it's like now I'm, you know, my draw a circle the size of a grapefruit, say, and that's my larger consciousness is in that, so that, you know, and that's one of the, you know, the ways that I think you sort of grow. And so there's that aspect of it, and then, you know, talking is the best thing, I think. And just constantly talking. As we both know, Mark, the tendency is that women want to talk, but the men want to not talk. And that's often a difficulty in the, you know, and because men tend to grieve, in, or not grieve in different ways, just, you know, it's, they're just not supposed to talk about it, I guess, if you're a man.
Sure.
That's the way the culture goes.
Given what you said, Dr. Moody, and referring back to life as a series of narratives, a series of stories, you feel like even the death of a child is an important story?
Yes.
One that contributes to greater love?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's the death of a child is a big part of anybody's story. This is in relationship to the parents, you know, who've lost children. And how these people come into our lives and we make an untimely exit and so on. I think that there is a broader perspective in which all these things weave together. You know, I have two grown sons and then two young ones, 15 and 13, both adopted at birth. And Carter is Mexican-American by heritage. We adopted him from Texas, and Carol Ann is a Blackfeet Indian. We adopted her from Montana. And, oh my God, it's just, what a wonderful experience. Both of them, as I said, it was at the moment of birth. We had them from the very beginning. And another thing is, I should say that my wife and I don't take kids to any religious ceremonies. And my wife, we don't talk about life after death at home. You know, that's my professional life. What we talk about is how the kids' homework, you know, what's for dinner, you know, the whole bit, and what's on TV tonight. And so the kids don't get any of this, but both of them have related memories of coming into you know, specifically choosing to come to us. And that has really focused me on this idea that we do seem to live not just one life, I think.
Makes lots of sense to me, and especially if you look at the research by Dr. Ian Stevenson, Brian Weiss's work, and so on. Great. Well, there's a question that's often asked, and since you're a pioneer in the after-death contacts, especially the facilitated type, and that is, after-death contacts are very common. Over 75 million Americans have had one. But people ask, well, why hasn't my departed loved one contacted me, and what can I do to enhance the chances of that?
Mark, the answer as to why some do and some don't is, honest to goodness, I don't know. In terms of the methods of enhancing it, there is an ancient modality. It was known all over the world of evoking the deceased through gazing into clear depths. And this was done in Japan at places where they would have these areas like parks where there were little ponds of water and with arched bridges over them, or in Greece where you would go underground and gaze into a mirror, like a mirrored cauldron kind of, and you can do it with mirrors. It was a well-known custom in the United States even until about, say, the 1910 or something like that, when radio came in. A lot of these Victorian things where people would participate in these things, sort of, you know, went away and people began to listen to the radio and then TV. But before that, there was this process of gazing into mirrors to evoke the spirits was just very well known. It's, you know, in Through the Looking Glass is a similar thing where people can project their consciousness through the mirror and so on.
Yes.
And so that's one way. And then there's also the ancient method of dream incubation by writing a letter to the person who's died and, you know, bring out, spill out your feelings and talk about your feelings and your questions. And then you fold the letter and you put it under your mattress and you just forget about it. And in many cases, that will bring about a sort of nighttime vision, which, you know, may not be experienced as a dream. It seems more real, or perhaps we might say hypnagogic or something, where, so, you know, there are ways to facilitate this, but I would certainly, from my experience of thinking about this, I certainly wouldn't experience, I wouldn't interpret any particular significance like that, that you don't see a loved one means that there's some kind of, you know, myth there or something. I don't think of it as that. I think we can't understand the you know, all the circumstances yet. Because what we're dealing with here is a sort of other dimension of reality that is kind of arched over this one in a way, and it's, you know, this one is infinite from within, but from the perspective of without it, it's not infinite. It's, you know, it's, there's a structure in mathematics, as you may know, called the Poincaré disk, which is the intersection of the Euclidean plane and the hyperbolic plane, and which shows that there can be structures which are from within, they're infinite, but from without, they are finite. And I think that we're living in one of those.
Well, excellent. Well, we have just a few minutes left, and so I want to tell listeners, Dr. Moody was just talking about his facilitated after-death contact approach, the psychomantia, and he describes this in great detail in his wonderful book, Reunions. And so make sure you read that. Again, his website, lifeafterlife.com. Dr. Moody, in the few minutes we have left, what would you like to share with others?
Well, yeah, I'm going to make a surprising prediction, and that is that I'm just, by the way, you know, logic was my thing, and my PhD in philosophy was on logic and philosophy of language and ancient Greek philosophy, and that's my field, and I got to say that I'm very conservative in my inferences, but I'm ready to go on and say that we have brand new, completely rational means of investigating the question of life after death, and we are now at a breakthrough, and I am really willing to say a breakthrough in the genuinely rational investigation of life after death, and that I'm not saying a proof of life after death. I'm saying new ways to give us whole new insights into this. So I think that we're in for a really sort of wake up with this. And I talk more about that too on my website. I mentioned the RaymondMoody.org has it too about these entirely new ways of looking at things.
Great. Well, thank you so much for what you've done over the years. I'll just thank you for people you've helped and reached, and you know we create ripples with our life, and then we have the afterlife reviews and get to see and feel all that, and yours is going to be wonderful because you've started so many fields of understanding. So for my listeners, if you want to understand more that you really are a soul and how you can live accordingly, Dr. Moody's work is one that you'll want to study, to look at. Again, his video with Dr. Eben Alexander. I've not had a chance to watch that yet, but I can't wait to do that. So again, his website, lifeafterlife.com and raymondmoody.org. Dr. Moody, thank you so much for being with us, and keep up the great work.
Thank you so much for having me on your program, Mark.